This podcast of To the Point is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
The brave new world of nanotechnology. Hello again, I'm Armin Alney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Tiny machines made of atoms and molecules sound like science fiction, but they're already with us. Cosmetics, stain-resistant fabrics, golf balls, and computers all contain manufactured components 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. Medical cures and pollution controls could be next, producing a $1 trillion industry by 2015, unless some unexpected crisis erodes public confidence. On To the Point, the benefits and possible risks of nanotechnology. What about oversight and accountability? On Reporter's Notebook later on, domestic spying and the war on terror. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation and the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation.
Hello again, Warman Alney, back with To the Point. Computers, cosmetics, and other consumer products contain manufactured components 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. That's nanotechnology, and it could be a $1 trillion industry in the next 10 years. On To the Point, what are the risks to human health and the environment? Is anyone really minding the store? On Reporter's Notebook, President Bush says domestic spying is a vital tool in the war on terror. Some FBI agents tell another story. We'll hear about that. First, this news update. The U.S. Supreme Court has upheld Oregon's assisted suicide law. The vote was 6-3, with Chief Justice John Roberts dissenting. Stephen Henderson reports on the court for Knight Ridder Newspapers. Stephen, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
First, the nature of this law and the action by the court, kind of a slap to the former Attorney General, John Ashcroft.
It's definitely a slap at him and generally a slap I think more broadly at executive assertions of power in the face of congressional statutes. The court is saying here that the Attorney General, or that the administration through the Attorney General, gave itself an inappropriate amount of power to decide these matters and to regulate medical issues, which typically have been left to the states. They said that the Controlled Substances Act, which Congress passed in the 70s, was not an appropriate vehicle to do that, and that Congress had no intention of giving that kind of almost unilateral power to the Attorney General.
So it said then that John Ashcroft attempting to use a drug law in order to control something quite different from what Congress intended, according to the court, had overstepped his boundaries. What does this mean for assisted suicide laws in general? Are there other states that are thinking about enacting them?
Well, I mean, I think it certainly suggests that you can do this, which is something that that the court has already said you can do in 1997. When they ruled on a Washington state law that banned assisted suicide, one of the things that they determined there was that, look, this is a state issue. There is no national sort of interest here, and that states can do what they want. And this attorney general effort was something that happened after that decision. So certainly this clears the way for other states to do it. I'd also caution, though, that it clears the way. It makes it clear to Congress that that if they want to stop this, they'd have to pass a new law to do it. And I don't know what the politics are right now on the Hill, but I would imagine that that's something that could happen. That you could have a new law passed that says, you know, this is not an appropriate thing for physicians to be involved in.
Again, Stephen Henderson, Supreme Court reporter for the Knight Ridder Newspapers. Now, it's interesting that the earlier opinion you cited, that individual states could decide what to do, was written by the late Chief Justice William Rehnquist. Now
right.
He's been replaced by Chief Justice Roberts,
yeah.
Who dissented in this case.
Right, he did. You know, I'm a little puzzled by that, and I'm still reading through all of the opinion and the dissent to try to pick up exactly what's going on here, and of course Chief Justice Roberts did not write to explain his own thinking on this. But one of the interesting things I noted was that in 1997, when the court ruled on that Washington state law, Roberts, who was then a private attorney, said on a news show that one of the important things that the court was doing was recognizing that the importance of individuals through their state legislatures being able to decide these things for themselves. And so I had sort of counted on him in this case. I had sort of counted him with the state. I'm not sure what it was that drove him away from that position in this case. It could be that this really is about the interpretation of the Controlled Substances Act. In other words, maybe he sees it as a more broadly written law, giving more authority to the Attorney General. But it's certainly puzzling, at least at first glimpse.
The other dissenters, Clarence Thomas and Antonin Scalia, in this 6-3 decision. Interesting that Scalia wrote an opinion saying that it is easy to sympathize with the idea that the federal government has nothing to do with all of this and it's none of its business. Nonetheless, he still voted the way he did in favor of executive power.
Yeah. And you know, his opinion is about, it's about statutory interpretation. He's saying that you can easily read TSA to give the Attorney General this kind of authority, and that the court's rules for how they determine when to be deferential to the executive branch and interpretation of laws would call for them to be deferential in this case. Obviously, that's a source of disagreement. You had six other justices say the opposite, but that's how he saw it.
All right, including Sandra Day O'Connor, who, of course, will soon, it appears, be replaced by Judge Samuel Alito. We'll have to talk at another time about what difference that might have made. Stephen Henderson, as always, good to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Supreme Court reporter for the Knight Ridder newspapers. Again, the Supreme Court has upheld the Oregon law, which allows assisted suicide. It's been used to end the lives of about 200 very seriously ill people. They have to be able to demonstrate by many medical opinions that they have incurable diseases and less than 6 months to live. That's important, I think, in interpreting what the Supreme Court did today. In a moment, the benefits and possible risks of nanotechnology. On To the Point.
To the Point thanks Factiva, a Dow Jones and Reuters company, for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 8,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Well, and I'll be back with To the Point. Nanotechnology means manipulating atoms to make things that are 1,000 times smaller than the width of a human hair. Most Americans may have never heard of it, but it's already an important part of many consumer products. Matthew Norden is Vice President of Lux Research, a nanotechnology consultancy in New York. Mr. Norden, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having me.
Interesting. Once again, the many people have never heard of nanotechnology. You have a consultancy firm that deals with it. Tell us a little bit more about what it is.
Well, it's an interesting topic because it's widely misunderstood. Nanotechnology is not essentially about miniaturization, about making things smaller in the same way that microprocessors have made smaller. What's more important is uncovering size-dependent properties of materials that are really different when you get down to these small size scales. A good example would be aluminum. If you have an aluminum can, you can burn it, kick it, throw it, crush it, nothing's going to happen. If you were to chop it into pieces that were about 20 microns in size, nothing would happen either. But when you get down to the specific size range, in this case at about 50 nanometer size particles, they'll spontaneously combust with air. You can use the aluminum as a rocket fuel. That's nanotechnology, size-dependent properties that emerge at scales generally under about 100 nanometers.
Well, now when you're talking about nanometers, what are you talking about? Is it possible to even see things that are this size?
Not without something like a transmission electron microscope. You're not going to be looking at this through a microscope that you would have in a high school classroom. For some reference, if you were to line up 10 hydrogen atoms side by side, they'd be about a nanometer wide, and a strand of DNA is about 2.5 nanometers wide. This is really small.
So we're talking about the tiniest things we know about in the universe, aren't we?
Absolutely, on the scale of atoms.
What about the use of this technology, then, in consumer products? Where do we already see it?
Well, it's funny. There are some cases where nanotechnology in consumer products is cited as a marketing attribute. For example, if you do so much as walk down the aisle of a sports store near your house, you might find Wilson Double Core tennis balls, which have a clay nanocomposite barrier coating on the inside of the ball that does a great job of keeping air from escaping. They last about 2 times longer than conventional tennis balls do. If you walk one aisle further down, you might find the Easton Sports Synergy SL100 hockey stick, which has a nanocomposite material in its core made out of a wonder material called carbon nanotubes, very small tubules of carbon that are much stronger than most other materials that are available today, even in their composite forms. But then there are other cases where you're not aware of nanotechnology in products that you may use very frequently. For example, every Chevrolet Impala has side-body impact moldings made out of a clay polypropylene nanocomposite material that is stronger than conventional talc-filled composites and quite a bit lighter. It's also used in every Hummer H2. If you were to go to a hospital and you had a burn on your body, you might be treated with a Smith & Nephew Actacoat bandage that uses nanoparticles of silver, which are able to have activity against hundreds of species of bacteria, and in some cases have shown antiviral activity as well, and do a good job of closing up wounds that don't respond to other treatments. In both of those cases, nanotechnology is not a core component of marketing the product, but it's absolutely core to its properties.
So it is then also, as I understand it, present in certain cosmetics, particularly sunscreens. So tell us about that.
Yep. If you think back maybe 10, 20 years ago to what high SPF sunscreens that a lifeguard might wear at a swimming pool were like, they were chalky white. And the reason is that they used compounds like titanium dioxide that are white in color, if the particles are big enough, that is. What researchers found is that if you take titanium dioxide particles and get them down to this very small size range, they're small enough that they won't reflect light, but they will visible wavelengths of light, but they will still absorb ultraviolet light. So they still serve as very good UV absorbers, but they don't give you that chalky white color. Today, almost all sunscreens with an SPF north of about 40 incorporate either titanium dioxide or zinc oxide nanoparticles. They've been investigated by organizations like the FDA in the U.S. and the SSNCF in the European Union and have been ruled to be safe in use for products like these.
So then you have named tennis balls, hockey sticks, automobile parts, bandages, sunscreens, just some of the uses now of nanotechnology. What is predicted for the future? It's my understanding that in 10 years this could become a $1 trillion industry. Probably won't happen with just tennis balls and hospital bandages.
Well, certainly not, and there's some clarity to bring to those numbers. If you look at nanotechnology applications today, they're mostly what we call gee-whiz nanoproducts. They are little innovations that have some incremental impact on the performance of a product, but they don't really change its performance and they don't massively change its cost position. The nanotech advances of the next decade will have a much more radical impact on the products that they go into. As one example, there's a drug for cancer therapy that is in phase 2 clinical trials in Germany right now from a startup called MagForce Nanotechnologies. It's iron oxide nanoparticles that are injected into the tumor site. You expose them to an alternating magnetic current, and they burn the tumor away from the inside without any chemotherapy agents or any radiation. Now, again, they're in early-stage clinical trials, but the results from the first phase had remarkable results on patients that had failed to respond to any other form of cancer therapy and were all given less than 3 months to live. When you think about the impact of nanotechnology on the economy, thinking of something like a nanotech industry is probably not very constructive. Mm-hmm. The reason is that nanomaterials and the intermediate products that they go into, things that are used to make other things, are pretty broad-ranging. There's a company in Japan that makes a bowling ball incorporating one kind of nanomaterial, fullerenes, that hugs the lane better. Merck and a startup called C60 are using the same thing to make drugs. For that reason, it's probably better to think about nanotechnology more like electricity or assembly line manufacturing as a process or an ingredient that makes lots of different products more valuable. By our calculations in 2014, about $3.7 trillion of global manufacturing output will incorporate emerging nanotechnology in some way. That's not all of it. That's not most of it. But it would be about one-sixth of global manufacturing output, and that's nothing to sneeze at.
How big is the market now for nanotechnology, if it's possible to generalize? I understand what you're saying about products that are very different from one another.
It is difficult to generalize, and a lot depends on definitions. By the definitions that we use, the market for products that incorporate emerging nanotechnology is pretty small today in the hundreds of billions of dollars. That sounds huge, but it's small in the context of global trade. If you change your definitions, you would get a different answer. Intel, for example, will argue to you that because the feature sizes, the sizes of the circuits on Pentium 4 chips since February 2004 have all been 100 nanometers in size, that those are nanotechnology too. Now, we don't agree with that definition, but if you did, then virtually every PC and laptop shipped since that date would be a nanotech product.
We aren't, unfortunately speaking, to an audience of graduate students, and I'm not one myself. What can you say about the process that you describe as nanotechnology? Is there a way to make it clear to lay people exactly what's going on?
Got it. I think one of the challenges of nanotechnology that confounds easy understanding by folks that haven't spent time looking at the technical aspects of the field is that there's not one process at root, there are many. So I talked beforehand about metal nanoparticles or metal oxide nanoparticles, like the aluminum that we discussed, that you can use to make rocket ignition fuel. There are lots of different ways to make that nanoparticle. There are many different startup companies, all of whose patents are based on different ways of making that structure. You can do it by mechanically milling it down, literally just grinding the particles until you get sizes that are so small that they have different properties. You can make them by doing esoteric things like pulsing plasma with energy rays, really complicated stuff. But there are many different processes you can use to get to these scales. I would say that if you wanted to generalize and back up, you could identify two big buckets that these different processes go into. One set of them are top-down processes, where you start with something big and you trim it away or perform chemical reactions on it or something in order to make it smaller. That's probably the majority of the type of processes that are used today to make these nanoscale structures. On the other hand, though, and what many folks think may be more promising in the long term, there are bottom-up processes, where you start with individual atoms of the thing that you're interested in, and you find a way for them to assemble into the structures that you're looking for. There is a company on the West Coast called Cambrios, a little startup based on research from a MIT professor, Angela Belcher, that proposes to grow semiconductor circuits by using, and I'm not kidding here, genetically engineered, genetically selected viruses to deposit individual atoms of silicon into structures that will form these circuits, form these chips. Now, chips based on that technology are easily 15, 20 years away. Cambrios itself wouldn't argue that to you. But that's an example of a bottom-up assembly technique that in the long term may be more promising.
But the, as I understand it, in both cases, what you end up with is something that still has the same atomic number and description as you started out with, but at this very tiny level, it behaves differently than it does otherwise. Is that right?
Absolutely right. And the important thing here is the discontinuity. With most properties of matter, you make something smaller, it gets weaker. You make something smaller, its boiling point changes, for example. What was found by researchers at the nanoscale, as soon as they got the tools they needed, the microscopes to investigate the world at this small size scale, which started really in the late 1980s and early 1990s, is that they found that the properties of matter changed in discontinuous ways, where there was a big leap as things got smaller. The example of those aluminum materials that when you get them to a certain size combust with air, which certainly doesn't happen with an aluminum can, is probably the most illustrative example.
Matthew Norden, again, is Vice President of Research at Lux Research, which is a nanotechnology consultancy in New York. David Rzhevsky is Director of the Project on Emerging Nanotechnologies at the Woodrow Wilson International Center for Scholars. Formerly, he was an EPA representative to the White House Council on Environmental Quality. He's co-editor of a recent book, Environmentalism and the Technologies of Tomorrow, Shaping the Next Industrial Revolution. Mr. Rzhevsky, thank you very much for joining us.
Glad to be here.
When you start talking about changes in the manner in which matter behaves, one is reminded of nuclear power, of genetically modified food, and the kinds of issues that have arisen when very promising technologies have turned out to have consequences that were not anticipated. A recent report from your organization indicates that that might possibly happen with nanotechnology. What are you worried about?
Well, it's interesting. In June, we ran a number of focus groups around the country on nanotechnology, and one of the participants made the point that nanotechnology is going to be extremely good if it's regulated properly, and that's a point that we heard again and again and basically from lots of people in these groups. People were very, very hopeful and excited about the possibilities offered by the technology, but they wanted some sense the government was on top of things, that we weren't going to see a replay of nuclear power, genetically modified crops. I think we have a great opportunity, actually, to get it right this time. We haven't seen any mishaps, no accidents. Everybody is excited about the possibilities. So what we did about 4 or 5 months ago is we asked Dr. Terry Davies, who's an expert who spent over 30 years working in and out of the federal government on public policy issues, to take a look at our regulations in terms of nanotechnology and answer a basic question. Will our regulation essentially protect us both today and into the future? And in some areas, he was pretty positive. He felt the existing system that deals with drugs, biomedical devices, food packaging, and pesticides would probably work with nanotechnology. However, there were other areas where he felt the federal agencies really lacked the legal authority and, in many cases, the resources to proactively regulate. These areas included cosmetics and consumer products. And he actually ended up recommending that we consider the development of new legislation that could provide very clear guidance to industry in terms of testing and safety protocols, at the same time providing greater protection to workers and consumers and the environment. I want to emphasize this was not an advocacy piece for a new law, but it's a piece of analysis that we hope that will be discussed and debated over the coming weeks.
What, you mentioned mishaps and accidents, which have not yet occurred. What could be anticipated at this point? What sorts of mishaps and accidents might there be?
Well, I think there's, you know, Matthew made the point, and it's a very good one, is that we know that engineered nanomaterials behave differently from conventional materials. So that raises the question, do they behave differently in the body if we're exposed to them or in the environment? And some research today suggests, yes, that's in fact the case. We know that if we breathe in nanoscale particles, that they can be more harmful to the lungs than the same mass of particles, of larger particles. Research suggests that they can affect the heart when inhaled. They may be able to leave the lungs and reach other organs, such as the liver. We see some studies that indicate they might even be able to go from the nose into the brain. There's other possible exposure routes through the skin, for instance, and through ingestion. In the future, through injection, if we get into medical applications.
But first of all, before you get there, if you breathe these particles and they go to the lungs, the heart, the liver, the brain, what might they do?
Well, we don't know a lot about that. In other words, an awful lot of the studies have been done essentially in animals right now. But people have seen impacts of the immune system. They've seen increased inflammation responses. So currently, the research raises some red flags, and it says that some of these materials may present a greater hazard than conventional materials. So until we better understand the risks, I think controlling the exposure becomes quite critical.
But people now, as I understand it, are using the sunscreens we heard her described earlier. There's also materials that are waterproof that are developed with nanotechnology. Are they at any risk?
Well, in terms of the sunscreen, I think it's an interesting case. A lot of the research suggests that there aren't any risks. The one case might be if you have people that have compromised skin where the sunscreens are applied directly to wounds. In the case of sunscreens, I think it's also important to think about what the potential benefits are. I mean, here we've developed a product that's, from the consumer standpoint, much easier to use, much easier to apply, aesthetically much better, and more effective, actually, in blocking out ultraviolet rays. In fact, some of the early applications of these products were, in fact, in Australia and New Zealand, where the people are exposed to significant amounts of UV because of ozone hole depletion. The benefits obviously are in the case of potentially preventing skin cancer.
Sure. Okay, we're going to come back, continue this conversation in a moment with Matthew Norden and David Rusevsky. We'll also be talking with Ray Kurzweil, another nanotechnology expert. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, has domestic spying by the National Security Agency saved lives in the war on terror or diverted the FBI from more productive investigations? Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
Transcripts of To the Point are available from the Transcription Company, 818-848-6500, or on the web at transcripts.net. A CD copy of To the Point is available by calling 1-800-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with talking today about nanotechnology on To the Point. Roughly speaking, the science whereby various substances can be reduced down to particles so small that they are where they remain the same substance, atomically speaking, they behave in different ways. Already they are present in many consumer products. We've just heard about some of the issues involving regulation, some of the things we don't know as yet. Let me go back on that point to Matthew Norden, the Vice President of Research at Lux Research. Are you concerned that if, in fact, there isn't some new protocol established by the Congress and by regulatory agencies, there could be the same kind of backlash that we've seen for nuclear power or genetically modified food?
Now, changes absolutely need to be made, and I don't think there is a level-headed executive in a company working on nanotech applications who would not agree with that. I think the question is much less if and more how. Looking at the Wilson Center report that you cited earlier, we're in pretty broad agreement with the assessment that these folks have made. I think the methodology is very sound, and I think it's clear that there are gaps in the current regulatory regime. We probably is a little too early to say that the U.S. government dropped the ball, not that anyone's making that accusation, but it is certainly appropriate to say they're in danger of doing so. I think the question, again, becomes how, not if, and the sunscreen example was raised beforehand, right? Application with risks as well as benefits. It's true that it's been shown that these materials are largely harmless if they are applied to the skin. What happens if they wash off your body in a swimming pool and a child drinks them? Is there a risk at ingestion? Well, there's a gap there in between the FDA and the EPA, and it's not one that can easily be filled now. So there are clearly changes that need to be made. Whether that requires a new law, I'm not sure.
We asked the National Nanotechnology Coordinating Office to be a part of the program today. They rejected our invitation. David Reshevsky, back to you at the Woodrow Wilson International Center. You've been involved in the regulatory area before. Do you think that federal agencies now are reluctant to get involved?
Well, I think that, I think there is a certain amount of reluctance. But I think that as you heard from Matthew, I think the real threat is not so much regulation. I think regulation, certainly, it can be done properly. It has to be fact-based. It has to be transparent. It has to be enforced evenly.
Well, we even heard from Matthew Norton that companies want regulation. Why do they want it?
I think that what they need is a clear set of signals. We get calls basically every week from companies asking us, should we test? What kinds of tests should we be using? How do we protect our workers? So I think one of the really optimistic parts of what I've seen is that companies are, I think, highly sensitive. Even small startup companies we're getting calls from. They're sensitive to the issues. They want more information. In a sense, they're kind of data starved. I do think that one of the things that regulation gives you is sort of a level playing field, as well as its ability to provide constant guidance, both to industry and I think also to investors. I think investors, and there's a lot of them out there that are investing in these companies, need to know that there's a constant kind of due diligence being done on the companies.
And Matthew Norton, isn't it also possible that if you have regulation, then the liability issue can be dealt with as well? If you've conform to the regulations, you're not as likely, if something unexpected goes wrong, to be hit for it.
Well, it gives you clarity as to what the range of outcomes is. Our clients are primarily multinational corporations, and at a significant proportion of them, there are nanotech applications that are interesting and valuable and have clear benefits and no obvious risks at the moment, but they're being stalled because in order to be developed, those business plans have to pass through an environmental health and safety officer. And that person goes out to take a look at, for example, at the EPA, what regulations cover the materials that would be used in these applications. And they come away saying, wow, it looks like these guys haven't really decided yet. And until then, we're not going to make a move. It's not necessarily bad, even if new legislation were to be introduced, which we don't feel is required in the least. But if that were the case, that would at least bring some clarity to the process rather than an ambiguity about what the range of outcomes are. And I would agree with David. I think that businesses are looking for that clarity.
All right. Our next guest is the recipient of the Lemelson MIT Award. That's the world's largest prize for invention and innovation. He's also author of The Singularity Is Near, When Humans Transcend Biology, and he invented the first reading machine for the blind back in the 1970s. He is Ray Kurzweil, inventor, futurist, author of a number of books, as well as the one I mentioned. Good to have you on our program.
Glad to be here.
If there were clarity, if the investors were freed up and allowed to start spending their money as they might, what could we expect in the future from nanotechnology?
Well, I think Matthew did a good job of describing the first phase of nanotechnology, which are materials, particles that have unique properties because of their small size and pick up different types of atomic and quantum effects that we don't see in more macro materials. But if we go out 10 or 15 years or more, we'll be able to actually create complex mechanisms where every molecule is where we want it to be. And these can be quite intricate and quite tiny. I'll give you an example of an experiment that's actually been done of a whole complex mechanism that is able to detect specific antigens that only exist on the surface of a cancer cell, latch onto them, migrate into the cell, know that it's inside the cell, and once it's inside the cell, actually start releasing certain chemicals. chemicals that destroy that, that cancer cell.
So that's the burning from within that we heard earlier about from Matthew Jordan?
But it's a complex mechanism. It's not just a particle. It's a whole little machine. And this actually is working in the laboratory dish because there's, you know, many steps to get that into use. Another scientist, also an experiment, but this time with animals, actually cured type 1 diabetes in rats with a little capsule that has 7 nanometer pores, so it is nanoengineering, lets out insulin in a controlled fashion, blocks antibodies, and actually cured type 1 diabetes in these rats. We're going to be able to create tiny little machines. Ultimately, we'll be able to put small computers in them, communication devices. We can have tiny devices that go inside our bodies, even inside our bloodstreams, perform diagnostic and therapeutic functions from inside. We'll also be able to create very powerful computers. Nanotubes was mentioned. If you have just a mass of nanotubes, it has unique properties. It's 50 times stronger than steel. But if you actually can place each nanotube where you want it to be, you can create fantastically powerful computers in 3 dimensions. In fact, the first generation of a nanotube-based memory is coming to market next year.
What's it going to allow? What is it? What could we do with that we can't do now?
Well, you can create computers that are very tiny and put them inside these blood cell-sized devices. So you could have a device that goes inside the body that has a bit of intelligence that can communicate on a sort of wireless local area network, and it can actually go inside and keep us healthy from inside. And there's some very interesting experiments that are already being done in animals or in petri dishes. So, if we realize that these things take a decade or so to get to market, we can see what will be possible 10 or 15 years from now. We're going to have fantastically powerful computers once we can build them in 3 dimensions. Chips today are flat. Our brain is organized in 3 dimensions, and that's key to its power. If we can organize our chips in 3 dimensions, which will require nanotechnology, basically have them self-assemble from molecules, we could create computers that are as powerful as the human brain or more so. We'll also be able to go inside the human body and the human brain. We'll be able to scan the human brain from inside. That'll be key to this grand project to reverse engineer the brain, understand its principles of operation, and apply those principles to very powerful computers that we'll also be able to create with nanotechnology.
Novelists and screenwriters have already gotten into the business of creating a nightmare possibilities with all of this. Ray Kurzweil, what are some of the real side effects that we might have to deal with if, for example, we were able to create computers that would be more powerful than the human brain?
Well, let me address the sort of quintessential issue with nanotechnology, which is self-replicating nanotechnology. Most of the dangers, or many of the dangers we see in the world, have to do with self-replication. Virtually all disease is something self-replicating out of control, a bacteria, a virus, our own cells, in the case of cancer, prions. And software viruses, for example, are self-replicating pathogens that replicate in electronic networks and are a grave concern. And we've actually put a technological immune system to deal with that. I believe it is feasible, and we will see 20, 25 years from now, nano devices that are capable of self-replicating, and that could be a very dangerous, form of weapon that we will need a means to protect ourselves from. And I think the solution is
just describe how that might work. We often hear about the gray goo. What does that mean? How would it be a dangerous weapon that we need to protect ourselves from?
Well, if you had a small device that can go out into a natural environment and take carbon, for example, which is abundant in the organic world, and find it enough materials to assemble a copy of itself, it's replicating the same way that a bacteria replicates. But it could replicate in a non-biological environment and ultimately spread and be kind of a non-biological form of cancer that could, sort of ravage the biological world if it's not controlled. And I think we will have to deal with that the same way we deal with software viruses. We will need a ability to detect these kinds of dangers and to destroy them, basically putting a technological immune system in place.
Before I get back to our other guests on that and the issue of regulation, what about the use of nanotechnology to generate energy? There are those who contend, as I understand it, that that might be the solution to the world's energy problems.
Well, I've actually written extensively in the book you mentioned, Singularity is Near, about that. We do see now emerging a new generation of solar panels and fuel cells, particularly solar panels that are very efficient, inexpensive, and lightweight. I do believe within 5 or 6 years we'll see solar energy make a significant contribution. If we could capture 1% of 1%, 1 in 10,000 of the sunlight that falls on the Earth, we could meet 100% of our energy needs. Now, we don't do that today because the solar panels we have are very heavy, inefficient, expensive, and so on. I've described a scenario which I believe within 20 years we'll be able to capture what will then be 3% of 1%, and meet all of our energy needs with extremely inexpensive, extremely lightweight solar panels that can be integrated with conventional building materials and capture all of the sunlight we need, store them in decentralized fuel cells that are also nano-engineered, that are at the opposite end of the spectrum from the centralized energy facilities we have now, like liquid natural gas tankers and nuclear power plants that are very centralized and very dangerous. These will be very decentralized, integrated into our environment, storing the energy where it's needed. And we will be able to meet all of our energy needs in a decentralized, renewable fashion. I believe that will happen within 20, 25 years.
I'm sorry to jump around, but there's just so much to talk about. Back to the question of self-replication, I understand that would not be a problem with the kind of technology you're talking about for generating energy from the sun?
No, not at all. I think things that we manufacture are not going to be self-replicating. We don't need self-replication in nanotechnology manufacturing processes. These devices will be manufacturing the things we need. There have been actually a lot of ethical guidelines proposed that are based on the so-called Asilomar guidelines that have guided biotechnology, because we have the same issue in biotechnology. We can create today a new biological virus that's bioengineered that self-replicates in the biological environment, mm-hmm. and that could be destructive. And that has not happened accidentally because we have the right safety guidelines in effect, and I think we can do the same in nanotechnology. The real concern is that some malevolent force, some terrorist organization, would apply this type of technology and create a new form of weapon, and we're going to need defenses against that.
Ray Kurzweil, once again, author of The Singularity is Near, in addition to many other books, and prize winner in the area of invention and innovation. Matthew Norden, quickly back to you. We're running out of time at Look's research. You said earlier you didn't think that new legislation, was necessarily necessary. What about public confidence, though, if, in fact, even all of you who talk so glowingly about the future prospects of nanotechnology have to concede that there could be side effects, would be pretty scary.
Absolutely. And again, I think that there is not an executive at a large firm or a startup that has his head on straight or her head on straight that is not thinking about those issues. I think there was a point at which one could do that in American industry many decades ago before there were shareholders with long positions holding you accountable and a history of disasters like with materials like asbestos mm-hmm. that had economic costs that could be quantified. But there is nobody on a board of directors who wants to be accountable okay. for bringing the next asbestos into the world.
So, David Rzeszewski, back to you. Is the Congress taking a look at this, even though at the moment the executive agencies don't seem to be too concerned about needing new rules and regulations?
Well, we testified in front of Congress, actually Matthew also was there in November, to talk about whether there was adequate research being invested to look at the environmental health and safety impacts of nanotechnology. A lot of that was focused on nanotechnology as we know it today, not the kinds of things that Ray was talking about. And I think it's just going to be really important in the long term to also begin to think about where the technology is going, because there will always be a risk that the policy is going to fall far behind the technology. And if that happens, it could put a real brake on the innovation and also increase the probability that accidents could occur.
All right. We hope this is just a program one on this subject for our program, To the Point. We look forward to talking to all of you again and to following up what happens in Washington and elsewhere with nanotechnology. David Rzeszewski at the Woodrow Wilson Institute for, International Center for Scholars, Matthew Norden at Look's Research, and Ray Kurzweil. Thank you all very much for being with us. In a speech sponsored by both liberal and conservative groups, former Vice President Al Gore said yesterday that President Bush has been breaking the law repeatedly and insistently. Gore called for a special counsel to investigate domestic surveillance by the National Security Agency without a judicial warrant. At the same time, two civil rights groups filed suit against the practice, and today's New York Times quotes FBI agents who say it may be a waste of time. More on that in a moment on To the Point.
You can find more information on the program, including archived editions, at www.moretothepoint.com. More to the point, all one word, .com.
We're only back to Popota's notebook on To the Point. President Bush has justified eavesdropping on Americans by the National Security Agency as a vital tool in the war on terror. Vice President Cheney says it saved thousands of lives. But current and former FBI agents tell a different story. That's according to today's New York Times. In an article co-authored by Eric Lichtblau, also one of the co-authors of the original report in the New York Times on the NSA's activities. Eric Lichtblau, thanks for coming back on our program.
Thanks for having me, Warren.
What do you hear from the FBI?
Well, this is really the first look that we've had as to how the NSA program played out at the FBI. The FBI, of course, is the lead domestic terrorism agencies, and they are the agents in the field who are tracking possible threats. And what we reported today was that the FBI was really just kind of flooded with leads from the NSA right after 9/11, many of them growing out of the eavesdropping program in terms of phone numbers, email addresses, some names, the vast majority of which did not produce anything usable in the view of the FBI. Now, there is, of course, the argument to be made that even one hit out of 1,000 or 10,000 is valuable when you're talking about terrorism, but the complaint from many senior FBI people was that these were blind leads with no sense of which ones were important, which ones are useless, or how they should go about investigating them. And there was a real question about how productive any of this was.
As a result of that kind of concern, the NSA came up with a prioritizing system, did they not?
Right. In response to complaints from the FBI, as you say, there was a three-tiered system that was put in place because the FBI was saying, we need more to go on. You can't just send us these blind leads.
What happened as a result of that? Are they able to point to any cases at the NSA, for example, where their surveillance led the FBI to crack a case involving the threats to Americans?
Well, the White House is saying very little at this point about specific successes. Vice President Cheney has said publicly that this program saved thousands of lives. The Justice Department, in an op-ed that was published today by the number three official in USA Today, said that it stopped attacks on American soil. But figuring out what that actually means and the accuracy of those statements is very difficult. There are a handful of cases in which we're told the eavesdropping program may or appears to have played a part, the two big ones being a plot by an Ohio truck driver to topple the Brooklyn Bridge, and then a second plot in Britain involving a possible fertilizer bomb. But there are major disagreements even among intelligence officials as to whether or not this program really played the role that some people say it did. There are people who still believe that, in fact, they got into both those cases through other means outside the eavesdropping program. So it's difficult to assess how essential or not this program was in cracking any terror cases.
Talking with Eric Lichtblau of the New York Times, we've talked a lot on this program about anonymous sources, the people, current and former people at the FBI, some of them at very high levels that you talked to, did not identify themselves. Why not?
Well, obviously, this is a sensitive subject. The Attorney General has said this was probably the most classified program in the government, and there is a leak investigation going on right now at the Justice Department into our original story. So I think that, for obvious reasons, people are reluctant to be identified by name. But at the same time, I think that today's story was evidence that there is some significant frustration among people at the FBI that they were willing to share on a background basis.
Among those who did speak on the record to you was the former Admiral Bobby Inman, who was formerly director of the National Security Agency, and he, as I understand it, as well as others, said that there may be a bureaucratic rivalry and a culture clash between the NSA and the FBI. What's the nature of that, and how might it explain what's going on?
Well, I mean, it's a phenomenon that we've seen both before 9/11 and after in terms of turf battles between different giants within the federal government, in this case the NSA and the FBI. The FBI and the CIA obviously had their share of battles before 9/11. You're talking about two agencies with very different cultures, and at the NSA, I think there's still a mindset among some people that the FBI has been too slow to embrace the post 9/11 mindset and is still trapped in kind of a law enforcement attitude that we're there to solve crimes. That's a charge that many at the FBI would deny, but I think it is strongly held by some people at the NSA. And then conversely, you have people at the FBI saying that the NSA does not have the training or the grounding in domestic law enforcement, as the FBI does, to sort of respect boundaries on privacy and the civil rights of Americans. So here you have a situation where the NSA's domestic role has clearly expanded, for the most part in secret by order of President Bush, and it is in some ways cutting into the turf of the FBI. So there's bound to be a backlash there.
And when you're talking about a culture of solving crimes, presumably they've already occurred, that would be different from the culture of trying to prevent terrorist activities. And then go back to what you said earlier about, you get 1,000 leads, and if one of them turns something up, maybe in that context, it's worth the trouble.
Right. I mean, the whole mission of the FBI since 9/11 has been to remake itself into a counterterrorism intelligence agency, and to stop terrorist attacks before they happen. I mean, that's a mantra that's been drilled home time and again by President Bush and the FBI Director Robert Mueller, and that's really a wholesale shift in the priorities of the Bureau, which historically has focused on ferreting out bank robbers and drug dealers and people who have committed crimes, not trying to stop people to prevent some future occurrence.
Again, we're talking with Eric Lichterbaugh of the New York Times. Now, in addition to the story we've already talked about, you also wrote today about lawsuits by the American Civil Liberties Union and the Center for Constitutional Rights having to do with this issue. Who are they suing, and on whose – are they suing the federal government, but on whose behalf are they suing? And tell us more about that.
Well, both those suits were filed today. The ACLU sued in Detroit, and the Center for Constitutional Rights sued in New York. And both name as plaintiffs individuals who say they have a reasonable suspicion that they may have actually been targeted by this NSA program. There's no direct evidence of that, but these are people, scholars, journalists, defense lawyers, and others. There's about 10 named plaintiffs in the two suits together who say, we frequently make international calls, emails to Afghanistan, to the Middle East. We are dealing in some cases with militant groups or people with strong interests or even connections to terrorism. And we want to find out whether or not we were targeted by this program, and the lawsuits seek an end to the program because they claim that it's illegal and unconstitutional.
You're a reporter. I don't want to ask you to make a judgment you don't want to make. But based on the first story, do their reasonable suspicions sound plausible?
It's almost impossible. No, since we wrote our first story now a month ago, there have been all sorts of rumors in Washington journalists may have been monitored under this program or political types. None of those rumors have been confirmed. And there's no direct evidence to suggest that, in part because the operations of the program remain so highly classified. There's been now a fair amount of discussion about the legal aspects of the program, but much less is known about the operational end. And at this point, it's impossible to know whether any given individual was or was not monitored under the program.
One of the plaintiffs in the ACLU suit is Christopher Hitchens. He's been on this program, man who's written in support of the wars in Iraq and Afghanistan, certainly though somebody who makes a lot of international calls, one would assume. Who are some of the others involved?
Yeah, there are a few surprises. Hitchens, as you say, has been supportive of military action in both Iraq and Afghanistan. Jim Bamford is a journalist and well-known author who's written two best-selling books on the NSA, and has generally actually been seen as someone who's had a cooperative relationship with the NSA. They worked with him on his last book, Body of Secrets, and so for him now to be a plaintiff suing the agency is a bit of a reversal. There are others in there, lawyers who actually work at the Center for Constitutional Rights and defend detainees in Guantanamo Bay and elsewhere in terrorism cases. There is a professor at NYU who deals international relations. Barney Rubin is his name, and a handful of others in academia, journalism, and legal work.
And if they're operating on reasonable suspicion, and if evidence is hard to come by because of all the secrecy that surrounds all of this, do you think these suits are as much to try to flesh out more information as they are to actually go forward in the courts and bring to justice the individuals or the agencies named?
Yeah, I think that a big agenda is just to find out more about the program and force the administration in a judicial setting to have to defend and explain some of its policies. I mean, I think if you had to handicap the lawsuit, as someone I quoted in the story said today, the chances of getting a judge to stop a program that the president has invested so much in, is a difficult task. And that will take some significant success in court, but it does seem likely that they will find out more about the program than we know to date.
Well, Eric Lichtblau, thanks for the stories you've been writing, and thanks for being on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Washington Bureau reporter for The New York Times. Today's program produced by Christian Bordahl with Karen Radziner and Andrea Brody. Technical director is Mike Newport. You can listen online anytime at moretothepoint.com. I'm Warren Alney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live as a co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.
You've been listening to KCRW's To the Point. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including Left, Right, and Center, our provocative, up-to-the-minute, witty confrontation over politics, policy, and popular culture, with Matt Miller, Robert Scheer, Tony Blankley, and Arianna Huffington. Check out the podcast of Left, Right, and Center at kcrw.com.